all those storage facilities, everything we did, it was me and my partner. Me and my dad started in it. And we just started to buy and turn around and learn as we go and screw up and figure things out. And, you know, that whole process, we got really good at it. And we thought, man, geez, we could do a lot more. Why don't we take our money and do more? So we started syndicating, and then we started doing joint ventures, which we had never done ever. It was just me and him. And that provided this way that we could still do what we do, yet other people got to join us and partner with us. And they got to participate in that. And we got more deals and we got expansion. So this win-win that you were talking about, that's actually become very satisfying to me.
You're listening to the Engineer of Finance podcast with Ken Green.
Hi, this is Ken Green, the host of the Engineer of Finance podcast, and I have a special guest on the show today, AJ Osborne, and he is the self-storage guru. And I can't wait. I've been really looking forward to this show. So thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for asking me.
So I've, I don't know if you know how much, I don't know how much you know about my background, but I used to do a lot of land development. And one of our clients had a storage unit that we were part of doing engineering work on, and seeing how these things operate, they are a cash cow.
Yeah.
A cash cow. And so for me personally, it's been a dream of mine for over a decade to find out how to get my fingers into the self-storage unit space, because it is a cash cow. And I'm a perfect example. I dumped my crap in a storage unit years ago. I don't even think I had a few sentimental value products, like to me, like my degrees somewhere in a box.
Yeah.
That's about it. I don't think I had a grand worth of storage of assets, and I was paying over $150 a month for 3 years.
Yep.
It's crazy.
It's crazy.
And I enjoy teaching on wealth principles and cash flow. And I've listened to your episodes. Some of them, you have over 100+ episodes. We'll talk about that. So I'll stop rambling, but please, I'm sure a lot of my listeners of the show would love to hear what you do in the self-storage space. Anything else you'd like to add to the podcast? But they are a cash cow, and mobile home parks, by the way. My gosh, are those cash cows too? Mm-hmm. And so it's a fascinating space. And the fact on how you do it, it looks like people can get in the game without having to have their own business of running a storage unit. Because there's a lot of regulation. There's some complexity. You got to deal with human behavior. So there's a lot to deal with. So I'll stop rambling. AJ, tell me, tell the audience what you do and tell us about the self-storage space. And I'll have some questions here and there for you, I'm sure.
No, the self-storage world's awesome. You know, I fell in love with it a long time ago, early 2000s. And it was a way for us to diversify revenue from our other business, which was like a health benefits brokerage firm. And me and my partner got into it, and then we got really big into it. And now that's our main business. And, you know, really, we do a good job at turning around underperforming facilities, which in self-storage is really easy. The economics of self-storage made sense to me very early on. And when looking at a lot of other real estate asset classes, I didn't really understand where I would fit in or how I would compete in those spaces. And the upside was just always so, what I felt like was limited. Now, this was obviously too a very lack of understanding of real estate, period. You know, I wasn't a real estate guy. That's not what I did. So I looked at self-storage though, and I said, listen, we got customers here. Let me back up here and start about the economics of storage and why I developed this kind of philosophical view early on that this asset was actually going to outperform other ones. And the economics of self-storage was simple. Our ability to consume, right, has only gone down. So our cost of consumption has only gone down. The ability has only gone up. And two, we've noticed a big change in these other real estate asset classes. Over the last 20 years, some of the most stable real estate asset classes in the world have been completely turned upside down. Self-storage, when I got into it, was not something you got into, right? It's not something that I went around and told people, oh yeah, I'm a self-storage investor, right? People are like, well, so you invest in junkyards. Like, you know,
which is interesting because I thought I saw self-storage. I was like, man, I can't wait to meet this guy.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. It's changed a lot now. It's, now it is the kind of the talk of the town. It's a big deal. But when we got into it, I mean, I was going and buying storage facilities and they're like, yeah, we want, you know, a 9 cap. And I just laugh. I'm like, I'll pay a 12. You know, it was like, I'm not paying a 9 cap for a storage facility in this town. Yeah. And now it's totally different world. And a lot of the changes have benefited us massively, as well as being in storage. It's easier to be in storage now than it was when I got started. In fact, it's substantially easier. And the upside to storage, once again, coming back to those economics, real estate is only getting more expensive. It's only more limited. And the laws that dictate self-storage have only become more cumbersome, right? So it's harder to build in lots of areas. And consumers, well, they're all downsizing. You have millennials that are now coming of age, which everyone said, you know, this was happening a long time ago, about, you know, 10 years ago, where they're like, oh, millennials are going to kill self-storage because they're minimalist and they don't hold on to things, right? I thought that was ridiculous, but it turned out to be completely ridiculous. Right now, the largest consumption of self-storage users are millennials. They surpassed baby boomers, and baby boomers are still fueling that market. And the reason is not because of what they like and don't like and what their personality is. It's economics. In order for you to go buy a 20 by 20 or add a 20 by 20 to your house, that is extremely expensive. And you have to take out debt. There's liability, right? The cost of land. And for you to go rent that space that you can get rid of at any time and not have the liability associated with it is very cheap, right? So the economics for consumers benefit relatively cheap in comparison, right? In comparison to what you have or what you would need to go buy to have an additional garage on your house. And so for most people, that's, it's a no-brainer, and we consume at vast rates, and consumption has only gotten cheaper. Right. But not only,
can you explain that? Cause yeah. I thought that was an interesting term. I just wrote that down because you mentioned it a little bit earlier. What do you mean by the cost of consumption has gotten cheaper?
So as
that's interesting.
Yes. As we've outsourced manufacturing and technology has come in to build it. You know, one of the big things that we saw is a twofold, the cost to build, create, anything that we want, it is dropped so substantially since the 80s, right? And before that, you know, it used to be only the ultra wealthy could have things like, you know, home appliances, right? And now that cost compared to our actual income has become a fraction of it. We've had so much competition. We've outsourced manufacturing, and businesses have gotten so much more efficient to get those products into our hands. Also, in the 90s, there became a thing called financing on consumables, which that didn't exist before either. Now, all of a sudden, we're buying motorhomes, we're buying bikes, we're buying everything. You can finance your computers, you can finance your oven, you can finance anything, your phone. And that didn't exist. So in the 80s, if you didn't have cash to go buy your new appliance, you didn't do it. Because you couldn't. And two, it was made in America. It was very expensive in terms of your income, right? And then you had another thing. Now you had a thing of distribution. So then we roll into the 2000s, right? So now if you lived in more of a rural area, right, you may only have access to certain consumable items. Amazon came and turned that all upside down. Now I can get anything I want at the cheapest price possible, and I can get it delivered to my house within 24 hours. So we've seen consumption rise.
Pre-COVID.
now it's maybe a day more, but it's, you know, you can have anything. And what they found was that the downfall of retail, it increased consumption. So we still consume more. And now that's only going worldwide, and that's going to locations that other people never had before. So as we see this massive rise in consumption, right, and this is only 50% of it, but as we see this massive rise in consumption, we're also seeing a correlation in the rise of your cost of living in association with real estate housing, apartments, right? That cost has only gone up.
Yes, it has.
And that cost has outpaced the rise in income. So what happens is space in a comparison to your income has never been more expensive, while consumption in comparison to your income has never been lower. And this has fueled an ability to have things, but not be able to store them. Now, there's another half of this, right? That's just the consumer part. We also have the business side. Lots of my storage facilities, we lease out to businesses. We don't lease out, you know, to all customers. In fact, a huge portion of our storage facility goes to businesses because we've had the decentralization of workforce. And this has been a massive movement over the last 10 years. Now we have people that can, all these Amazon products that you buy, that doesn't come from Amazon. That comes from an entrepreneur who's selling their stuff on Amazon, right? So these people now have a decentralized workforce. You have small businesses that they also have the same problem. I have inventory, I have logistics, but yet the cost to buy and store those logistics, lands, industrial space has skyrocketed. So we have a huge portion of our facilities that are rent out to businesses.
Just for inventory?
They're not going to go buy
it. That's it? Just to store boxes and boxes of
inventory
products?
For anything they need. They have trucks, cars that they take out, they ship out. That's a very large portion of our business model. And that has just skyrocketed in the last 10 years. And COVID has just literally put that, you know, on crack. It's just blown up. And two, 2020 is the highest start of new businesses that we have seen in the United States in like forever. It's over a decade. So people are more entrepreneurial now, right? We have side hustles. They're starting up vast majority of new businesses because they can do it online.
Now you have a podcast or a blog on the side hustle.
I have a complete one dedicated to entrepreneurs because I own multiple businesses. Mm-hmm. I don't just own storage. And this advent of space and the economics for it has fueled the self-storage industry. Now, the gains of self-storage have also changed. So what has happened in self-storage is you have all of this inventory that was built. Remember, self-storage is the newest real estate asset class on the market. It's the newest thing that's ever come up. That's why before 2008, not only did people not take it seriously, but banks didn't even like it. Like there was banks that would not even invest in self-storage before.
Oh, well, that's a shocker. I mean, you can't apply logic to the banking banks, industry,
right? So normal people couldn't get in.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, well, hold on here. You know, what are you going to do? How are you going to finance this? How are you going to, they just didn't even get it. And two, they thought, a lot of people thought self-storage was a fad, which is ridiculous, but they did. And I think it was because of two reasons. So banks couldn't underwrite it because their models couldn't project through a long-term debt cycle. They didn't have the ability to, because self-storage was so new, it had never survived one. That meant there was risk that they weren't going to take on. And two, a lot of people didn't think it would have, because there was this theme that said people will get rid of their self-storage unit so fast, right? No one is going to default on their home before they get rid of a storage unit. And that turned out to be completely opposite, which was also ludicrous to me. I'm like, wait, so somebody's going to keep paying their $1,500 a month mortgage and they're going to keep they're going to let go of their $50 unit? Which one's going to make more of a financial impact, right? And so that turned out to be opposite. So during the recession, storage not only survived, it did very well.
It thrived.
Yes, it thrived. And where we look at self-storage today, and it's changed because since 2000 right to now, so the industry has changed massively. REITs are huge now. But the biggest number and the biggest reason that I like self-storage is this. 74% of all self-storage owners are mom and pops. When you go into single operators, they own one storage facility. If you go into multifamily, it's inverse. There's only like 15% mm-hmm. are mom and pops, or 20%, right? What that meant to me simply as a business guy is supply, demand, and opportunity. I needed a market to buy product. I needed a market that I could buy product that would work out for me. Self-storage had lots of products that were owned by mom and pops that would sell to me, institutions I wasn't competing mm-hmm. over. So I could buy it. And I could buy it at a better rate than I could these other assets. It's a very simple concept, but one that makes sense. So if the economics behind storage made sense, and for me made a lot more sense than a lot of the most other real estate asset classes, now can I get into this market? Can I buy it? And the answer was there was more opportunity to get into self-storage than there was any other asset class on the market. Because also there was mobile homes are the same as self-storage, right? It's predominantly mom and pop, but mobile home parks still to this day are very difficult to finance. And so the landscape wasn't there for me to obtain and scale. Now, the third part of this. All right. So we've talked the economics. We've talked about the product on the market. The third part of this is how do I execute? How do I make a difference? I'm a business guy, right? I want to come in. I don't believe that the assets make me money, right? I come in and I make the money. And what I mean by that is I don't speculate. So I don't expect it to say, oh, this is going to be great in 10 years, right? I need to know today that what I'm buying, I only go off cash flow, is going to produce me good cash flow that I can reinvest back into my business, buy more, and compound my returns, right? In a lot of real estate asset classes, I never could buy. I tried to get into multifamily, everything like that, because my brain didn't work like that. It didn't work like, no, listen, they're paying down your debt and you're getting appreciation while it's paying you know, you may get a little return, but it's okay because you're still making money, which that works. I'm not even saying that it doesn't. It's actually totally true. But in my business mind, I could only work on cash flows because I came from cash businesses. So self-storage, I looked at it and said, I could buy this. Mm-hmm. There's all of these product types and there's no real true market. What I mean is a storage facility a mile down the road from me at one of my storage facility does like 30% or 40% less revenue. The exact same product. Why? Because I run it better.
Okay. I'm sure you're going to tie into that. And I liked how you, I like delay gratification. I'm a very patient person. At the same time, when I'm looking at investments, I think it's way too overlooked, especially like in the stock market and Wall Street, and a lot of financial advisors is cash flow. It's all about cash flow. That's money you get to enjoy and use today.
The only thing that matters.
And having this buy and hold strategy, whether it's real estate or the stock market, waiting 20, 30 years before you can touch that money, why the industry is enjoying the use of that money today, I just never understood.
Well, and two, you lose what makes people wealthy. Compounding.
That's right.
That's what makes people wealthy. Appreciation doesn't make you wealthy. Appreciation is nothing until you use it.
That's right.
It's nothing. It doesn't even exist. So I'm buying storage facilities. I'm getting appreciation, which is great, but I don't do anything with it. It was like, great, maybe I'll do something in the future. But at the same time, I'm taking that cash flow and I'm buying more storage facilities. Mm-hmm. So I'm sitting there compounding my results, right?
Correct.
And as we compounded, it sped up. Now we have more storage facilities. And then, you know, before we knew it, we were at $150 million in assets. We have whatever it is, six developments going on right now. And we've got a whole department team where we're buying and we're fueling and we're growing even more. That was because of cash flow, because cash flow creates appreciation.
Are you East Coast to West Coast? Are there certain areas that you have focus on?
Yeah, East Coast to West Coast. We don't have a lot in the East Coast now, but I don't care where. I care about the deal. And that's also something I think that was very different from a lot of real estate investors. They're like, I'll pick a market and I'll go into the market. And for me, I'm like, that's not necessarily nearly as important to me as the asset itself. So not that it's not, if the market's bad, I don't buy in it. And I can, and I'll get into that here in just a second. But what I'm really looking at here is I'll go to New York, I'll go to Florida, I go to Kansas, Iowa, California, Washington. If there's a good deal there, I'll go there, right? I don't care. Because I want a good business. That's what I want. And that's how I view it. I view it, this is a business and I'm going to buy a good business.
You mentioned mom and pop, and if I can, and I go on tangents everywhere. And again, thanks for coming on the show, because this is such a fascinating topic. And I think a lot of people are going to enjoy listening to what you have to say with storage units, because everyone just dumps their stuff there. And I think it's been very interesting. You have a lot of millennials, strong incomes, but as you pointed out, real estate has gotten very expensive. I mean, Midtown Reno, Northern Nevada, very expensive. Right. And so what do? They have a lot of toys. They got RVs, vans, they get the storage units. When you're looking at a storage unit.
Yeah, they put them in my storage unit in Reno.
Oh, very good. So you're here locally. That's good.
Yeah.
So what distinguishes when you say that, hey, it's got a pencil, it's got to have the cash flow, it's got to have things. When you go to acquire a storage unit and you mentioned that one right down the street is not near as competitive as the one you're looking at acquiring. Is that before you buy or after you buy? I mean, it sounds like a value add of what you're doing. You've got systems in place. You've got a good team.
Yeah, it's a value add. People have probably heard of like the Burr strategy. I simply call it money on the table. So what I'm looking for is the money that's sitting on the table.
The what strategy? Can you repeat that? Because that sounds great. How do you spell that?
So yeah, it's an acronym. If you listen to Bigger Pockets, you know, it's BRRR. I think it's you buy, rehab, finance, rent, and repeat. I think I got that down.
Is there an exit strategy when you buy these storage units? Like you mentioned, you have one, at least one here in Reno.
No, I keep them forever. I sell them. I'll sell a few of them, but I don't plan ever on selling. My strategy is I want all my money back out of it completely in 3 years, and I want it non-recourse. I want unlimited future gains without any risk. But
money back within 3 years between just cash flow?
Nope, refinance. I want to refinance my initial capital out, but it better be paying me a 20% return along the way.
So a cash out refi.
Mm-hmm. And then we hold it then forever, and we'll do the refi. Usually we're putting it into non-recourse loans.
Okay, got you. And then you said are you over 150 million in mini storage?
Yes.
Assets now?
Yes.
And am I saying that right? I say mini storage. Maybe that's an old school term, but storage units, mini storage.
Self-storage, yeah.
Self-storage.
Whatever. It's all the same. It's fun business. That's all I think about it as. Yeah, because, you know, you got to realize that when you're looking at these assets, right? When you're looking at storage, it's different and you got to approach it different, right? But when I'm buying, I'm looking for what I call the money on the table. And the money on the table is what it's currently doing and to what the existing market is also doing. Now, this is really important. This is not speculation, right? So I'm looking at multiple things through revenue management. I'm looking through like dynamic pricing, right? And I'm looking through operations. So if I know that Bob has a bunch of 10 by 10s, Bob's 90% full, but Bob's 20% below market, right? He's not running it really well. He's not doing dynamic pricing. That means all his 10 by 10s are selling for the exact same thing, right? I know, and I can come in, I can look at that and say, you're 20% below the market. You're not running it well. I can put it exactly into my model, which I will spit out exactly what I am. And the spread between his performance and what is actual, like what the market is currently doing, that's what I call my money on the table. It's money that's sitting there on the table. He's just not taking it. And so then I can come in, buy the business, and extract that money off the table. And so I'm not waiting. It's not like I'm like, oh, he's not doing a very good job. So in 10 years, I'm talking within months. Like I'm coming in and I'm taking that money off the table like in months. And then we hold it and then we'll refi after 3 years, take all our capital back out. It'll still be cash flowing great, produce a great return. And then we hold it forever.
Can you walk me through that a little bit more? So when you said the majority, 70% plus or mom and pop holders, what's their motivation to sell to you? Why are they selling? They just want out and we'll go to retire in Florida because it's too cold in Nevada?
It's all over the board. I mean, when you look at mom and pops, it can be a transition from generations. It can be, you know, death, divorce. It can be, you know, they're just sick of it. Like lots of people, they get into it. And one of the biggest misnomers, you know, you hear is like, oh, I like self-storage because you don't have to do anything. And if any of your listeners hear a self-storage owner say that, please contact me. I would love to get a hold of them. And that's a big misnomer. But a lot of people got into it. And two, a lot of these assets are old. So they were all built before the business model changed. And mm-hmm. It wasn't built on service. It wasn't built on anything. It was built as basically a land hold. So we're going to throw storage units on here, right? And then in 10 years, we're going to turn it into apartment complexes or what they viewed as something useful or something that'll make money, right? And they didn't do anything. It just literally people had their stuff in, collections, you know, were good. They had no late fees. They weren't marketing. They didn't have any systems or processes in place. There was no revenue management. So all of a sudden you're sitting there looking at it and you're like, I don't have to do anything except change your operations around, put a decent marketing strategy in, and we're going to increase your revenue by massive amount. I mean, some of them we've doubled. Once again, I'm not talking years. I'm not talking the market went up. I'm talking a very short period of time.
Now, doubling the revenue, you're buying it from, they're out. So what do they care if you double it?
They don't.
What am I missing here?
They don't care at all. I only care.
Yeah, this one. So how fast is it when you come in, you see a great opportunity, you have a listener call and said, hey, I have a, you know, that says a storage unit owner that says they don't require any work. When you come in and you identify a property that makes sense, typically how fast does it take to close? I mean, you own private equities.
Like close the deal?
Yeah, fund them. Give them their money. Get out.
If I find a property, it's usually, it depends on how we find them. So I find deals in a few ways, right? So this is probably good for your listeners. This has not only nothing to do with self-storage, just if you're in investing in real estate and anything like that in general. So I have a philosophy. It's called, you know, be the bear. If you're standing by a river, right, and you got your fly fisherman, I'm a fly fisherman, and he's sitting there and he's trying to match the hatch and he's trying to figure out what the fish are eating. He's hoping that the fish are holding in a certain spot. He's hoping they're passing. Like, there's all these things you're trying to do to catch the fish. Then you got a grizzly bear that walks out in the middle of the river, sits on top of a waterfall, and the fish just jump into his mouth, right? So when you're looking at investing in real estate, you want to be the bear. Just go sit down and let the fish come to you, right? So when I find deals from a few ways, and the ways are that I've tried to set up is to be the bear. We have special broker relations like everybody does, right? All off-market deals. I've never bought a deal on the market. They bring deals to me. When I get those deals are already teed up, right? It's like, okay, we're going to close in a month or two, right? The next way that I go through and I find deals is I find deals through, you know, actually targeting. So I'm out putting fillers out. We're sending out messages, right? We're doing all that kind of stuff. And then the third way that we find them is through outreach and networking, right? Like, this is why I get on podcasts, right? This is why I have my book, my self-storage income podcast. And I give all my information out just for free. I'm like, I'll tell you how to do everything.
How do you get your book for free? Because I was looking at your step one, step two, step three. And by the way, for everyone listening, I have all your stuff in our show notes. So everyone knows how to reach out to you. I saw on Amazon for $19.99. So how do we get that for free?
Come on. So we do our giveaways or special on site. I have to pay Amazon. So that's a little harder to do. But
I was just curious. I was about ready to buy your book. I don't know how to get
to. Now, I mean, that's a lot of podcasts and everything, but you exactly.
A lot of episodes.
But, we don't hold back. I tell it once again, exact strategies. And I'm like, listen, we do case studies, graphs, everything. Cause if everybody knows what I want and how I do it, they're going to give me a call and say, hey, AJ, got this deal. It's exactly what you talk about. And I'm like, awesome, let's do it. And then we partner up with people and we get deals done. So I try to do outreach. I try to explain what we're doing and I try to make other people money. And that tends to work very, very well to get deals and to capitalize on
it. I call them win-win relationships.
Yeah, bingo.
It's amazing, especially in this financial industry, the scarcity mindset.
Yes.
Where if you have this mindset of abundance, I love joint ventures. Not necessarily partnerships, but joint.
Yeah.
Being married, that's a powerful partnership.
Joint venture,
that's enough. Yeah. Yeah, joint ventures are very powerful. And so these type of strategic arrangements where this is an opportunity for people to come in and joint ventures with you, right? Where it's a win-win relationship. Everyone, and you have this mindset of abundance. It's just, and everyone wins, including the people selling to you because you're satisfying a need and a reason why they're selling those storage units, self-storage. Yeah. One of these days I'll say it right in this episode. Self-storage units, you're fulfilling a win for them. As win for you, and as win for people who are coming with you. So, what are things? I know we only have a little bit of time left. What are some other areas that we can address? Like, how do you help people make money in self storage?
You know, so this is a funny thing because I never syndicated ever. Like all those storage facilities, everything we did, it was me and my partner. Me and my dad started in it, and we just started to buy and turn around and learn as we go and screw up and figure things out. And, you know, that whole process, we got really good at it. And we thought, man, geez, we could do a lot more. Why don't we take our money and do more? So we started syndicating and then we started doing joint ventures, which we had never done ever. It was just me and him. And that provided this way that we could still do what we do, yet other people got to join us and partner with us. And they got to participate in that. And we got more deals. And we got experience. So this win-win that you were talking about, that's actually become very satisfying to me because I'm like, hey, this is a great way. And two, when we go into cities, by the way, they want us to take over the storage facilities. Perfect example is we bought this storage facility. It was kind of dumb. We tore down the front. It was on a main road. We built a nice showroom, a nice front, right? We're cleaning them up. We're making them high class. We're making them, you know, really nice products. So the city wins in a big way when we come in. I actually had a city after one of our development send us a thank you letter. How many times has a city ever sent you a thank you letter for developing something for a storage unit?
For a storage unit?
They're like, we've never seen anything like this.
Can you disclose that city? Can you do that or you'll get in trouble sharing what the city is?
If you go out on my Instagram, one of the facilities right on there. But they were like, we always thought that this was a crappy product that nobody liked in junkyard. But they're like, this is the nicest thing on this entire street.
Well, you mentioned on one of your episodes in your podcast, which is in absolute alignment with me. And I was just having this conversation with my assistant this morning. It is so important for me to elevate others. It is so important to every client, 100%. whether a if they're a potential client, not a client, they come in my door, they get on the show, they on the phone. I want them to leave that conversation feeling elevated.
Yeah.
And to do that, nothing is allowed to be mediocre. It all has to be at an exceptional level. And it's one of your episodes. I can't remember which one, but I wrote in my notes, never do anything mediocre.
No.
And you talked about the importance of how going from earned income to passive income and how this is a great vehicle to do so, or one of.
Yes.
And so that really resonated with me.
Well, and two, and I think I love what you just said there because, you know, and maybe I'm just a people pleaser too, but that brings me a lot of satisfaction when I improve other people's lives, right? It just does. I think that's everybody. And I found my weird little place in the world to do it. And that's self-storage, which nobody cared about ever, but now it seems to be doing something, which that's great. I love it, right? And when I look at things, and I'm a big believer in that you don't do anything mediocre because your time that you have, listen, that time that you have is spent on something. So no matter what, if you're going to knock it out of the park or do it mediocre, the time is the same. So knock it out of the flipping park, right? Go big.
Agreed. I mean, I might differ a little bit. I think it's just a little bit extra. I did a podcast talking about mediocrity, and I think it's a little bit.
10%, and that 10%.
But it's really nothing. I mean, it's just a little bit extra. But that little extra separates doing something a phenomenal product and service versus a mediocre one.
Yep.
But when you look at the use of your energy, you have more energy than what you started with.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, when you do it that kind of, it's just pure joy. So you mentioned, and the reason why I bring this up is you mentioned having a showroom. I didn't know self-storage units had showrooms. Oh, yeah. That's right there. Sounds pretty extraordinary. Now, is that something specific to just what you do or do your competitors have showrooms?
They're starting to do that. So lots of storages don't. But if you go into, you know, ours and the ones that we build, they're big, they're open, there's products. It's like kind of has a lounge feel to it.
Can you define big? What does big mean?
Yeah, let me think here. I mean, or one that we built, you're talking 20-foot ceilings. It's probably 800 square feet, maybe more, just the front office area. Very well lit. We do lots of windows, open it up.
In the storage unit?
Yeah.
Storage unit has windows?
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah.
Pretty neat.
Yeah. We try to make them nice. In fact, you can go down into Reno and check out our one right off the, on your way to Tahoe. It's right off the exit. It used to be the old Kmart. So it was a big Kmart.
That's yours off of I-80?
Yeah. It's fine. Yeah.
Yeah. I knew a long time ago.
Storage right there.
Oh, that's great.
Where they're building all those big apartment buildings right next to us.
Oh, yeah. Does that have a showroom in it?
It does. Go check it out. It also was also one of the first keyless entry systems in the world. You can buy your storage unit, everything right off your phone, access doors, everything from your phone.
Yeah, I was watching that get put together and I was like, that is a smart move. That is a smart move. So, and that's shocker. Your fingers were on that one. So that's yours. That's pretty cool.
Check it out. It's a great
how one. You mentioned the syndicated and in some way, it always feels like I fold time on. I mean, I could talk to you for an hour or so. I know you're incredibly busy and my producer says, I guess a little bit shorter shows. It's like, but I this stuff, I really, a couple of questions on that. You mentioned syndicated and joint ventures. So how people listening, I mean, you're getting money coming in to help create this velocity money. So you can do more and more, right?
Yes.
And compound that money by using the cash flow to purchase more assets.
Yep.
That create more passive income.
Yes.
The What kind of investor can invest in the syndicated real estate? Is it Reg D? Does it have to be accredited investors only? How does that work? Can you dive into that a little bit?
So we have right now, we do it on a per project basis. So okay. we're a little different. We don't do a fund and go out and buy. Not that we won't, but what we're doing right now is we have developments. We just did an acquisition in Kansas City, and it was a $6 million acquisition that one of my podcast listeners called me up. And he's now a really good friend of mine. His name's Zach. He's like, hey, there's this facility. It's $6 million. It's everything you talk about. I think there's a big spread in the market, very different. And he's like, I've talked to the owner. And I'm like, great, let's partner on it. We did a joint venture. We had a general partnership that was us. And he got part of that. And then we have limited partners, which were accredited investors that came in and they invested with us on that one. And we purchased it and took it down. That's how we're doing some of our other developments. So right now, our projects that we have in the works and that we've done right now, our developments, those have been accredited investors. And accredited investors is dictated by the SEC. Like, right, as you know, all these things are dictated by the SEC and who can... Yep, rules, and more rules. And that's generally how we structure it, though. We have a general partnership with limited partners. The limited partners come in and do the deal with us. They're actual owners of the facility. They get depreciation, the cash flow, and everything else.
What else can I ask you about it? Because how do I play the game with you? I mean, I always like leading through example. I don't ask anyone who listens to the show or my clients I work with to do anything I'm not doing myself. So what is kind of like the minimum entry level for someone who wants to play the game with you? And how do people come in on the joint venture side? Read your book, understand the game and say, hey, we got a deal that, how does that, walk us through that?
Great question. Really, when we're looking at our joint ventures and everything, the best way and the easiest way that I tell people is I'm like, hey, listen, get out there and try to find a deal. Like, that's what I do. That's what everybody does. And once you have a deal, then everything else you can figure out. So we can see how good is the deal. And then we'll work with you on that. And
now, does your book tell you what's a deal?
Oh, yeah. We tell you how to underwrite.
Okay. All right. So everyone's self-educated on it. So and when they podcast, come to you,
you can go. And really what we look for is 60,000 plus square feet in a market that's growing, right? I don't need it to be booming like, you know, Boise or Texas or Reno, right? It just needs to be growing. Maybe not
LA.
Yeah. No. Yeah. I'm staying away from the cities that everyone are fleeing. So we definitely don't want to see those cities that are having the mass exodus. We don't want those. And 60,000 plus square feet. And then from there, you know, have a relationship. Yeah. Like, please don't just send me addresses. That's one of the things when we joint venture with people, we actually want them to be partners and to do work. So go out there and contact the owners.
Doing the vetting, relationships, exactly. Asking questions, understanding the motivation of why they don't want to play this game anymore.
Bingo.
Those type of things.
Absolutely. And then those, you know, you come to our site, Self Storage Income, and there's literally a tab that says, you know, hey, I got a deal or something like that. Put it in and we get back immediately. We have our director of acquisitions and he and me team up and we get back to people. We underwrite deals. And if you guys got somebody that wants to sell, we'll get on the phone, we'll work, we'll figure out, and we'll tell you exactly. I'll do all the underwriting for you and tell you how much it's worth. And if you want to partner up, we're happy to.
Now, what's their commitment? How does that work? Usually some skin in the game from them financially, but also I would assume some type of time commitment as well, right?
Yeah. So, and that's how we judge on basically what the partnership will be, right? So like the one in Kansas City, they got the relationship, they got it under contract, right? They did all the work. They got 5% of the GP, which is just free to them. And
can you explain to anyone listening, GP?
Yeah. So the general partnership gets a percentage of the equity of the deal for doing all the work, right? Doing all the deal. And they got 5% of that portion for free. Now, the limited partners, that's where the capital comes in, right? So I'm a limited partner in all my deals as well as the general partner. So I'm literally putting in, you know, all our money in right along with the investors. So it's not like you're an investor and I'm up here doing things. No, I'm right alongside all of them. And so he came in then too alongside. So I put my money in the deal. He came in and then we had other accredited investors that came in and put their money alongside us.
Yeah. Where are you, the other accredited investors? Because there's probably another way to play the game with you.
And that's right.
Maybe So how, what is that?
Even if you're not an accredited investor, that doesn't mean we're not opening up and allowing to non-accredited investors. But if you go to selfstorageincome.com and just go straight in there and say, hey, I'm interested in investing with you, then it gives you a place to put all your information, everything. And we shoot out our deals to those lists and we have contact you. And my director of investor relations, she's touching base with all of them saying, you know, you put in there, how much money do you want to invest? And then that puts all those people, they obviously get first shot. So we won't even talk about a deal. All those people get to see the deals. And then if we want to go out from there, we do, but we never need to.
Couple things, your website, you mentioned selfstorageincome.com. Your podcast, I don't want to butcher it.
It's Self-Storage Income Too.
Yep. Well, don't you have a cash flow too?
I have two. Yeah. So Self-Storage Income. This one that is just, so I started Cash Flow to Freedom, which I'm so nerdy about finance and passive income and financial freedom.
Yeah, I enjoy
that. I want to talk. Yeah, I love it. Right. And so I talked about businesses, how to make personal changes in your finances and the things to do and not do and how to create opportunity in your life. Mm-hmm. That's Cash Flow to Freedom. But I made another one called Self-Storage Income because so many people wanted something specific to self-storage.
Yes.
And on that one, we don't talk about anything.
You just dive straight into the weeds.
Straight into it. Every episode is only about self-storage. And it's the largest one in the industry by far. It's just blown up. So Cash Flow to Freedom, financial freedom, starting business, entrepreneurship, and investing. And then Self-Storage Income, if you're like, listen, I really want to understand just self-storage, all I do is talk about self-storage.
I get really hyper-focused on stuff. My wife would say obsessed. And so I could easily see how just listening to a self-storage podcast and all the episodes could be easy rabbit trail to go down to, especially if it's fascinating to you. And it's pretty amazing. I can only imagine at different events and parties, it's like, oh yeah, I love these self-storage podcasts.
Yeah. If you're
like, but it's like, wow, what?
You're interesting to party with.
Why would someone be more attractive? We got a couple minutes and thank you for coming on the show. It's been a blessing. I think the listeners are going to love listening to your input. Maybe we can have you come back, do a part two down the road, because I have a whole litany of questions to follow up with. Why would someone want to gamble their money in, and I say that loosely, gamble? Well, not necessarily the stock market. I mean, it's my bright and shiny object. There's pieces of the stock market are fascinating to me. I do not think it's a strong place to start. You have to create a foundation. You got to understand principles and apply it and have that kind of philosophy. But once you have the liquidity and things are in place, and I love teaching clients about the Bankosaurus. Maybe one of these days I'll come on your podcast and explain what I do there for my clients. What would attract someone to the self-storage space as opposed to gambling their money in the stock market?
Yeah, there's two real important differences when you're investing. There is what I call retail investors, right? And that's a pretty wide term. And then there's more active investors. I view retail investors really as this is more of wealth preservation, right? Because if you look at the stock market and you say, I'm getting a 6% annual return or 8% or whatever the stock market will do over 20 years, if everything's tied
with a lot of risk, it promises nothing.
With a lot of risk. If you need your money out in a 5-year period of time, you don't want to be in the stock market because it could be shot for years.
Agreed.
But over the long term, the stock market goes up. It does. I use index funds. I have IRAs that have money in the stock market. But that it's not like I get anything from that, right? If it goes up, great. But I have no control over that whatsoever. I can't do anything with it. It doesn't pay bills. I can't really compound it. I can try to sell high, try to sell low. It's a whole thing though, right? When you're dealing with active investors, you get tax breaks, right? I hate paying taxes on stock. It drives me crazy. Like, I'm like, I didn't get anything from it. And like, yeah, you pay taxes. But I got a real estate asset that pays me every single month cash flow for me to pay my bills and increases in value to a tune way over 10% because of leverage. And I get depreciation. I don't even have to pay taxes on it. And so I look at the stock market and I'm like, this sucks. I'm like, you know, and granted I get there's money to be made, everything else in it, but you don't get the tax benefits. You don't get the cash flow, right? But you still get the appreciation, but you get appreciation with leverage on a hard asset that is controllable. That is very different, right? I would never use leverage in the stock market. That is scary. And so it's just, it's, you just get less, you don't get nearly as much. And for me, once again, this compounding nature, I can refinance or I can use the cash flow to put it back to work. You can compound so much faster. There's just no way that I would have been able to accrue $150 million in assets without taking massive risk in the stock market and doing options and using other people's money and leveraging, you know, doing those types of things. And I would have had to been, I mean, the top of the world to get that kind of return, right? I would have had to been like a major hedge fund in order to do that kind of stuff.
So
I didn't need to do that. I could be an idiot from Idaho and do that.
Stealth storage, I mean, what you hit on is, I always teach, and we want to get simultaneous benefits with our dollars. And so, you know, as you pointed out, real estate can be, I don't like the word tax shelter, but per our code, it can be a very powerful tax shelter, right? And reduce those opportunity costs. So that's money not being taken from the IRS that allows you to leverage into more real estate.
Bingo.
And cash flow and appreciation. And so it's thank you. You would think self-storage units, you just hear it, you think it'd be a boring topic, but I knew it'd be fun. And people, it's nice getting a nice income streams. When you talk about double digit returns, that's pretty attractive for people too. And AJ, thank you so much for coming on the show. I know we got to wrap it up. Everyone listen to the show. We're going to have more awesome guests like AJ Osborne. So thank you. If you have any questions, please don't hesitate to reach out to my website. Go to engineeroffinance.com. I post a few blogs here and there. And if you have any questions on anything financially, don't hesitate to reach out and ask me a question. AJ, I'm going to have all your show information in our show notes for everyone to reach out to if they have questions. And anything else you want to leave with the listeners? Anything else of how to reach out to or any questions, you know, or what do they do?
I think first of all, in investing in real estate, if you're interested in self-storage, whatnot, don't ever be overwhelmed and don't be like, oh, I don't know how to do this stuff, because none of us do. I knew nothing about real estate, period, when I got into self-storage. And realize that it's a process and it takes time, right? But the understanding of the benefits overall and the future outlook, that's where you need to decide to put your efforts. And if you are interested in self-storage, once again, we provide absolutely as much information as I can. You can go to Instagram, AJ Osborne, and I try to respond to everybody. I don't think there's a person that I haven't got back to. It may take me some time, right? But I do. I get back to everybody on there. My team gets back to everybody. The podcasts are, you know, we bring guests on. So I'm really trying to give as much information out there for people to make good decisions. So please do reach out and check everything out. Go to Instagram, AJ Osborne, selfstorageincome.com, and we blogs, videos, YouTubes. We're trying to put out as much information as we can.
And I'm looking up your book and also The Investor's Guide to Growing Wealth and Self-Storage.
Yep.
Probably a good book to start with, right? Yeah,
number one rated and sold self-storage book in the world. So we're really proud of it.
5-star rating. Congratulations. That's awesome.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, AJ, thank you so much for coming on the show. To all the listeners, I'm so grateful to be able to be behind this microphone every week and try to provide the best content possible. So thank you, AJ. Thank you to all the listeners. And I look forward to next week's episode.
Thank you for listening to the Engineer of Finance podcast with Ken Green.